In 2018, the Environmental Protection Agency measured that the U.S. generated 292.4 million tons of solid waste. That's just under 5 pounds per person. And that, dear listeners, is a lot of trash. While some of this waste can be recycled and repurposed to live a new life, the current sorting process requires human labor that is extremely dirty, dangerous, and frankly, quite dull.
You're listening to Found, TechCrunch's podcast that brings you the stories behind the startups. And today we're talking to Rebecca Hu, the CEO and co-founder of Glacier, an AI robotics company that is building robots to accurately sort recycling. I'm Becca Skutak, and here learning along with me about what really happens to your Amazon packaging is my amazing co-host,
Dominic Midori-Davis. And before we get into our conversation with Rebecca, we have our two truths and a lie. And at the end, of course, we'll tell you which one of these statements was a lie. So, is the lie in this conversation that the robots are named after Taylor Swift songs? Is the lie that if you're not sure if something should be recycled, you should just toss it in the recycling? Or that thin plastic bags cannot be recycled in a lot of places?
Ooh, that sounds like the making for a great conversation. Dear listeners, you'll have to continue to listen on to find out which one is true and which one was the lie. And this is our conversation with Rebecca. Hey, Rebecca, how's it going?
I'm doing very well. How are you guys?
I am doing well. You know, such an honor to have someone on the show who also shares the best first name in the entire world.
I've always said it loud and proud, but glad to hear you agree.
What could be better? We don't have Rebecca on the show to talk about that. Thankfully, we are talking about something more interesting. So maybe if you want to start by telling us a bit about your company, Glacier.
Absolutely. Glacier is building AI-enabled sorting robots to help improve both the traceability as well as the actual recovery of all of these high-value items that we're throwing into our recycling, much of which ultimately ends up in the landfill.
One question I had before we dive in too far, what got you interested in the recycling space to begin with? What drew you to want to fix problems in this space? Because I know looking at your background, you've worked in a couple of different areas. What drew you to this space to begin with?
So my background is definitely very multidisciplinary. And I think you can kind of read between the lines there and see that for a long time, I felt like my goal of my career was to keep as many doors open as possible for as long as possible. But when I started learning a little bit more about what was really going on behind the climate crisis, behind all of the issues facing us in terms of our planet's sustainability, it was really the first time in my life that I thought about a life devoted to working on the circular economy. And I said, you know what, if this is what I pigeonhole myself for, that will be a life very well lived. So if we rewind back to roughly 2019, 2018 or so, this was a time when a lot of headlines were coming out about the climate crisis and how we were hurtling towards climate death unless we did something very quickly to fix it. And I think it became very clear to me that there are a lot of really important problems to work on in the world. But for me personally, it felt truly unconscionable to be spending all of my working hours working on anything but helping to mitigate and ultimately solve the climate crisis. Now, within that, in 2019, there were also a lot of headlines coming out about recycling. And to give you some context, previously, China had been the world's biggest customer of our recycled goods. So we would, you know, sort out all our recycling. A lot of it would end up getting shipped over to China. They would reprocess it, turn it into new feedstock, and then sometimes send it back. And the fact of the matter was a lot of the world was sending China incredibly contaminated recycling. Effectively, it was just trash. And so overnight, China passed something called the National Sword Policy, which said, you know what, we're sick of taking the world's trash and landfilling and incinerating it. So unless you can, you know, quite literally clean up your act, our borders are closed to you now. And this really sent the industry into a bit of a tailspin as everyone was trying to figure out, how the heck do we actually keep the lights on? And so that posed a really interesting opportunity for me and my co-founder, Areeb, to actually get involved into this entire landscape from both a climate angle, as well as just taking advantage of a really huge market opportunity to inject new innovation and new technology to help a very old and critical process work a lot better.
And so when we were kids, it seemed like the best thing you could do for the environment was recycle. But what's missing in that messaging?
Definitely. If we're going to solve the climate crisis, fixing recycling on its own, frankly, is not going to be enough to dig us out of this hole that we're in. But one of the incredible things about recycling from a sustainability perspective is that it's kind of a ready-made solution in the sense that the infrastructure already exists. And if we can find a way to make that entire system more efficient, we can reap the benefits of our improved recycling infrastructure and at the very least buy ourselves more time from a climate perspective. When we think back to when we were kids, I think a lot has changed since then, or perhaps a lot has been made more apparent over the decades. One thing that really struck me was just how quickly our waste and recycling stream is evolving. And so when you think about the packaging innovations that have occurred over the past several years or even decades, it's been great because we found new ways to use new materials to create more shelf-stable products or, you know, different modes of consumption. But what's also really complicated is on the back end, it creates all of these crazy new challenges that recyclers need to figure out in order to determine how are we actually going to extract value from the material stream. You know, one of the things that Glacier's technology seeks to do is to try and simplify or at least automate some of that challenge of, you know, sorting our materials better on the back end. Because let's face it, as a consumer, it is near impossible to figure out perfectly whether something is actually recyclable or not these days.
That is the truth. When you see like those three bins and it's like compost, waste, trash, recycling, I'm like, I don't know where this cup goes. I hope it finds the right place. I'm sorry to this cup.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that was somewhat counterintuitive and frankly a little upsetting to me when I started digging into recycling is this phenomenon of wish cycling, which in other words is exactly what you described, Dom, where, you know, you see a thing and you're like, I don't know if it's recyclable or not, but maybe if I put it in my recycling bin, it'll end up in a better place. And in fact, what a lot of recyclers would tell us is if you're on the fence, maybe it's better to not recycle that thing, because if that thing isn't recyclable, it actually makes their job a whole lot harder. And, you know, as someone who is an ultimate wish cycler up until a couple of years ago, this was definitely not a great thing to find out. But, you know, it's one of those things that I think really could help our entire recycling system function a lot better. The last thing I'll mention on this front is that Glacier, in looking at this whole circular economy we've set up, we decided that the most interesting place to start having an impact is at the recycling facility level. Because when you think about it, that's where a lot of this material is getting aggregated. And if you want to have a machine that can identify and sort what's in the recycling stream, that's a really good place to start. But what it's really going to take is a huge amount of collaboration from everyone involved in the circular economy. And so one of the things that Glacier is already starting to work on is to figure out not just how do we help these recycling facilities react to a changing waste stream and extract more value from our recycling, but also to take that all the way back to the beginning and say, can we use the data we're collecting and the insights that we're learning to actually go back to these big brands and manufacturers and producers and educate them on what design principles actually ensure that the end of life for their packaging is significantly better for both their bottom lines as well as the environment. And so we really want to come full circle with that.
And something I wanted to ask about, you came to this problem with the recycling industry, decided to focus on the manufacturing side of it or the recycling centers as opposed to, say, a consumer-focused product. Was building robots to fix this issue your first idea, or sort of like how did you come to that approach that this would be a good way to take a first stab at fixing some of these problems?
Before I dive in, it might be helpful to just give an overview of how that post-consumer process works so we can kind of situate where the Glacier robot exists in that ecosystem. So when you as a consumer put all of your recyclables into your recycling bin, it gets taken to what's known as a MRF, or a materials recovery facility. I was so tickled for way too long by that acronym, but
that is so funny. MRF.
So this MRF is essentially a factory whose job it is to take this giant mountain of commingled recycling, and certainly a lot of it is also trash. And then their job is actually to sort that into all of its constituent commodities. So in an ideal world, at the end of the sorting process, you have these beautiful mountains of aluminum cans, paper, plastic, cardboard, you name it. And then they can sell that material to manufacturers to be turned back into new feedstock for new products. As you can probably imagine, that sortation process is incredibly challenging for a number of reasons. And what's also shocking to a lot of folks when we talk to them about Glacier is that a significant portion of that sortation process actually still has historically relied on manual labor. So imagine people standing next to conveyor belts for 8 hours a day, and their job is just to try and grab certain items out of that, effectively that recycling or that waste stream. Now, to get back to your question about was the robot the first idea, it was a really big part of our initial conception of Glacier, because at the time that we were talking about how we could best help the recycling industry, not only were recyclers really struggling to figure out how to keep up with these increasing expectations around purity rates, but they were also starting to deal with a looming labor shortage. You can imagine that these jobs are incredibly dull, dirty, dangerous. It's kind of the epicenter of that trifecta. And as a result, you were seeing that it was very difficult to actually meet those quality standards without having to find somehow overnight a huge amount of additional labor. And so for us, it felt like that recovery element that our robot provided was actually a critical part of the equation.
How do you train robots to do this job? I don't know. Every time I think of a robot, I think of like evil robots that like attack people, which like is not like the truth. Like that's just what I see on Twitter, I guess. But like, so how do you train a robot to do this?
One of the incredible things about what we're building at Glacier is that a lot of the technology we're using, whether it's the AI, whether it's the robot, a lot of it would not have been this commercially feasible even 10 years ago. And so one of the exciting opportunities with Glacier is to really apply this cutting edge innovation towards a very real world problem. To actually get the robot to pick things out of our recycling stream is an incredibly difficult feat, because when you think about the recycling stream, there's a huge amount of variation in what you need to detect. Even if you're only going after aluminum cans, let's say, they come in all different kinds of colors. They might be crumpled, torn, stuffed into a bag. There's a lot of different variation that you need to train for. The way we do it is we put our AI camera, so our vision system, above, let's say, a conveyor belt at one of these facilities. And then that camera just starts taking images. And you can get, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions of these pictures relatively quickly, given how much recycling is coming through the system. And then what you're starting to do is you're looking for the items that actually matter. And so what I might say is, if I were to teach a human toddler, hey, this thing is an aluminum can, they might not be able to recognize that a second different item is also an aluminum can. But if you give them 100, 1,000, a million examples of aluminum cans, they get pretty good at pattern matching. And from a layperson's perspective, that's exactly what we're teaching our AI to do. And then that AI, that vision system, acts as the eyes of the robot, which can then know there's an aluminum can coming. It's in this location. I'm going to pick it up and then I'm going to sort it into this bin, which I know is for aluminum cans.
Oh, wow. Do you also train it? I guess you also train it what not to pick up then, right? Because I'm thinking of the wish cycling thing. Like if it sees, I don't know.
The wish cycling robot.
The wish, they're just like, no, this cannot be recycled. And do they like throw it away?
It's a great question. The short answer is yes. So I'll give you an example. When you talk to recycling facilities, one thing that everyone is pulling their hair out about is plastic film. So think about, you know, like those grocery shopping bags, trash bags, you know, snack bags, that really light filmy material. It's a relatively new type of packaging that's ending up in the recycling stream in this volume. And the issue is that it goes everywhere. So it contaminates everything, right? So one of the things that our robot is now trained to do is to actually sit on, let's say, a line that's supposed to be all paper and cardboard. And it knows specifically to target that plastic film, pull it out and send it basically to the landfill because it may not have any value.
Wait, those things are not recyclable?
This brings us to another incredibly confusing part of our recycling infrastructure, which is that depending on where you live, it may or may not be recyclable. And I think the challenging thing for all of us as consumers is to know, you know, what is actually on our curbside accepted list or not. And so there are communities that will accept that type of material, and there are many others where they say, you know, we're unable to find any sort of end market to sell that into, and therefore it's not worth our while to actually separate it.
That is so interesting, because I'm curious if that has any impact for you guys of how you are training these robots, if it's like where they're going to be based necessarily. If they're in different recycling centers, they may be looking for different things.
Well, this is one of the incredible capabilities of AI, and where a lot of the potential lies, I think, is the immense adaptability of the system. So the way that we think about it is, on the AI side of things, we're essentially creating a taxonomy of stuff. Right? Like our vision system needs to know this is a plastic bag, that's a PET water bottle, et cetera. And then what's neat is that we can also know a lot about where a certain robot or a certain vision system is located. And we can even tell it, hey, we know that in this geography, these are the things that are accepted and these are the things that are not. And that way, this robot can essentially instantaneously sort the item that it knows something to be into, yes, this is a good thing, or no, this is a bad thing, depending on, you know, what community it's operating in.
And I'm curious, what has it been like building an AI-enabled business like this? Because you guys obviously did not just start last year when everyone started going nuts about AI, even though, of course, as we all know, people have been building companies using AI for a very long time. But what has it been like for you guys building in the AI space and sort of seeing that investor perception change? And I mean, you could say the same thing for climate tech as well.
The AI piece of our backbone has definitely been hugely important. And I think there are a lot of ways to take that roadmap, which I'm happy to elaborate on. What's been interesting to me is to sort of see where perception meets reality. And I say this from both an investor and a customer perspective, because I think for a lot of us who are just hearing all these stories about how AI is incredible or AI is terrible and AI has all of this potential, there is sometimes this perception that, hey, you know, why isn't it as easy as just putting an item in front of an AI model and it should automatically learn how to detect that, right? And the fact of the matter is that it is still incredibly challenging to figure out the right way to train these models and get them to actually perform in a real-world environment, especially one that's as intense and as variable as a recycling facility. So I think on one hand, it certainly has taken a lot of work to even get our AI model to where it is today, which is that it can identify a little over 30 different types of categories of items. On the other hand, you know, we're constantly trying to stay attuned to all of these new technologies that are making it easier, faster, cheaper to train our AI models. And so we are definitely seeing the acceleration of that innovation picking up over time.
And think about the investor side of it, too. I know you guys just announced funding this week, so congratulations on that. But how has fundraising for this company been, and has it changed since this AI craze, this new focus on climate tech has started?
Yeah, it's interesting because roughly speaking, this focus on AI and climate tech has kind of coincided with the bottom falling out on the fundraising market. And right. So it's a little bit hard to piece out, you know, what's bringing us up and what's pulling us down in that regard. I definitely think, you know, investor interest has picked up, particularly on the AI side of our business. And the questions that we get there are certainly, you know, just as a thought exercise, they're becoming increasingly interesting. Like, what could this AI actually do at scale? I think what's also funny is that investors, at least some investors that I speak to, it's clear that perhaps they've been burned by other misconceptions around AI. So I actually had an investor at one point ask me, is what you're doing actually using AI? And I had to sort of probe for what they meant by that question. And I think what they were getting at is that perhaps they've encountered companies that are trying to shroud everything they're doing in this mystical cloud of AI to benefit from that on the fundraising side, and that perhaps behind the scenes, they were doing a lot of, you know, manual identification or manual work to make it seem like there was an automated system. And what I tell these investors is, like, you know, if you're asking me that question, you've never seen how much stuff is coming through every single second in these facilities. It would be near impossible for us to somehow have an army of people behind the scenes trying to frantically right. identify every single item so that our robot can pick it half a second later, right? So it's been interesting because I think there's an element of education that comes along with touting what we're building.
That is so interesting because I've heard a lot of people, investors, talk about that concept of being like, oh, some companies we talk to market themselves as AI, and then you get in there and it's like, not really. But I haven't heard of it from the other side of you being a founder and someone being like, is this really AI? And you're like, yep, let's take a look. That's so interesting.
Absolutely. And I do think, you know, we see this with both investors as well as our customers, like these recycling facilities, where I think there were a lot of starry-eyed folks that were really, really excited to jump in and embrace the full potential of AI. And now, perhaps after experiencing some of these less fortunate situations, they're taking a step back and being a little bit more cautious and discerning in thinking about what can AI do for us today or in the near future. And I actually think that's really good for us as an industry, because it doesn't serve anyone to sell a really, really lofty vision with no expectation of being able to hit that anytime in the near future.
More from this conversation right after a quick break.
How did the relationship with Amazon evolve?
Yeah, the relationship with Amazon was, you know, one of those kind of classic fortuitous moments where you see a window of opportunity as a founder, and then you just kind of grab the bull by the horns. You know, if we rewind a couple of years, Glacier actually participated in a recycling-focused program sponsored by the state of Washington. And we were kind of just there doing our little demo day pitch. And unsurprisingly, it turns out there were a lot of Amazonians in the audience because this was in their headquarters town, city. And so I ended up just talking to a couple of these folks, just seeing where the conversation would go. And it kind of snowballed from there, where one person introduced me to another person who introduced me to another person. And it kind of just became clear to us that our technology could plug in so many ways across the Amazon value chain. So from all of those conversations, we actually started a commercial pilot with them late last year. And I think it was around that time that we also started having conversations with the Climate Pledge Fund. And what's neat is that I think the Climate Pledge Fund not only saw the market potential that Glacier had generally. But of course, if you're a fund that's advocating for the strategic business interests of a particular company, it's obviously amazing if this startup is already proving that it's adding value to your business units. And so I think that definitely was the catalyst for the subsequent conversation and investment.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I guess they're going to be using it to see what happens to its packaging as well to help with that. What happens to our stuff after that? That's really interesting. I've never thought about that. Like, I also have no idea what happens to anything after it goes through this process.
I am very glad you're mentioning that, Dom, because the dirty truth is that no one really does until very recently. That was one of the things that immediately struck me as my co-founder and I were thinking about entering this space is, you know, we were like, what is the data that's available and how does that point us in the right direction on what to build? And it turns out that the data surrounding our waste and recycling streams, certainly there's a lot of data, but it is incredibly difficult to aggregate and actually analyze it in a way that lets us do something about it. So I'll give you an example. When you think about something like, you know, what is the composition of material that's entering a recycling facility? You know, like what percentage of this stuff is aluminum cans versus PET bottles versus something else? The way we currently do it is we, being the industry, will hire a couple of people and they will literally pull off maybe a half ton or one ton of material and they will hand sort each item in that ton. They'll categorize it, they'll weigh it. And then at the end of this, you know, 1 to 2 week long effort that costs tens of thousands of dollars, you have this snapshot in time of like one ton of material for a facility that processes sometimes, you know, hundreds of tons a day. And then you just assume that that's the case for the rest of the year. So when you kind of roll that out to a company like Amazon, they obviously have a vested interest in understanding where is all of our stuff going? Are people actually recycling it? Is it ending back up in our value chain or not? And in our conversations with the Amazon team, that was a huge part of what appealed to them. They've spent a lot of time in recent years optimizing that front half of their production for sustainability. For example, reducing the amount of plastic packaging or shipping boxes without the additional box around it. But through those conversations, it became clear that they didn't really know what was happening after it got to the consumer. And of course, if they want to be responsible stewards of their entire value chain, then they actually have to know what's happening in the back half of that equation so that they can do something about it.
And that leads into something I wanted to ask you about too. Because recycling as an industry had gotten so bad and things weren't going well and stuff like that, and things had changed, obviously, like you mentioned, with China wanting to buy our recyclables and not, what is the demand like for this? It sounds like companies like Amazon obviously seem to care about being able to figure out what happens to their packaging once it goes to consumers, but what is demand for this like?
Sure. What's been really interesting is over the past year, we've really started to expand our aperture from our core recycling facility use case, where it was always pretty obvious that there was immediate operational benefit from learning from the data and using our robot. But we started to go out to the market and say to major brands, to manufacturers, to municipal and state government agencies, like, if we could put this data on the recycling stream in your hands, what would you do with it? And what you're seeing is that there are different but incredibly powerful use cases within each of those segments. So we'll take brands, for example. I think there are a couple of different reasons we've seen that brands actually want access to this type of waste stream or recycling stream data. The first is certainly from a sustainability perspective, a lot of brands are becoming increasingly conscious about where their packaging is actually ending up. They can't actually do anything about it until they have the information that tells them, you know, this is the recycling rate or this is the type of packaging that does or doesn't get recycled by consumers. And the reason for that is, I would say, in part because it's the right thing to do. And pretty much every major brand has put out these sustainability commitments that are incredibly lofty and they now need ways to hit it. But one other really big incentive for them is something called Extended Producer Responsibility Laws, or EPR. And so there's a lot of this landmark recycling legislation that's now coming online across a handful of states, soon to be many more, that says, hey, if you're a company that's putting a large volume of packaging onto the market, you actually need to pay into a system proportionally to how recyclable your packaging is. So if your packaging ends up being incredibly difficult to handle and recycle responsibly, we're going to need more money from you in order to actually build that infrastructure. And so for brands, a lot of it becomes, holy cow, there's dollars on the line. And now I really need to think about how to present packaging that actually is disposed of responsibly. Otherwise, I'm going to have to pay into this other system that's going to require a lot of bells and whistles to handle it well. The last thing that I think is interesting for brands is actually not even related to sustainability. But what a lot of folks don't realize about recycling is at the end of the day, it is very much an industry focused on the supply chain. So when you think about the amount of plastic or aluminum or whatever it is that's needed in order to help these brands continue to make all of the stuff they're making, for a lot of these commodities, there's actually a huge shortage. And so these brands, even from just a supply chain perspective, have a vested interest in finding new ways to recover more PET plastic, for example, in order to actually meet the volumes they need to hit certain requirements internally.
And shifting gears just a little bit, more over to the personal side of being a founder, I know you have past experience at a startup because you worked with Thumbtack, which we actually had on the show last summer. But I'm curious, even though you had some of that background in startups, what was it actually like for you actually launching a company of your own?
I think contrary to a lot of founders, I actually oftentimes refer to myself as a reluctant founder. I didn't really have that much interest in starting a company, or so I thought. And it really was this confluence of very urgent market need, climate impact, and then the ability to apply this very novel technology in ways no one really had before. That was very, very interesting to me. I was very committed to working somewhere within climate tech, and I was starting to get very interested in what was happening within the recycling and waste ecosystem, in large part because of National Sword Forcing, this paradigm shift. And then it turns out that my co-founder, who was a friend of a friend, had recently left his job at formerly Facebook, now Meta, as a software engineer. And he was kind of coming at it more from the technological angle. Anyways, we were both screaming from the rooftops that we were super interested in trash and recycling. And it turns out for some reason, that's kind of a niche interest, apparently. So our mutual friends were like, you know what, just talk to each other. Like, we don't want to hear about it. My co-founder, Areeb, had already started tinkering with this idea of applying AI and industrial automation to help solve some of these challenges he saw. And I basically told him, look, I'm not interested in starting a company with you, but I can help you write a business plan and do this preliminary industry diligence to figure out if there's a company to be had here. And in so doing, I basically accidentally convinced myself over the course of a couple of weeks that this was, you know, the opportunity of a lifetime, and that I would be foolish to not at least try to take it on in order to have a shot at making the impact that I wanted to.
And how big is your team right now?
We're a little over 20 people.
20 people. Okay, so something I love asking, how would you describe your leadership style?
A couple of words come to mind. Consensus-driven is one thing that I think I've always tried to embrace. And, you know, over the course of the years, you know, there's a dark side to that too, right? It's kind of impossible to always have perfect consensus on every topic. And so there's a certain balance that I'm learning along the way of, you know, how do you make sure that you're soliciting new information, new opinions, and making everyone feel heard, but then also effectively driving to decisions quickly and figuring out ways to resolve conflicts, because those will always exist. Another word that comes to mind on our leadership style, mine and my co-founders, I think is just openness to new information. I think that we are in an incredibly complex industry, especially when you step beyond the four walls of the recycling facility and you think about all the other players that have an impact on our circular economy. And so, you know, even now, almost 5 years in, I'm learning new stuff left and right about, you know, what actually is needed to make a difference here. For us, there's very much this cultural value we try to embrace, which is what information would be needed to change your mind on something? And we ask ourselves that constantly. And I think it ensures that we never get too dogmatic about a certain approach or a certain belief.
Wait, no, actually, there's something I'm really interested in. With a company like this, who is the first person you hire that's like not you and your co-founder? Like, who is your first hire?
Yeah, so my co-founder, Areeb, and I'd like to think we both have a pretty realistic understanding of our skills, our strengths, and our weaknesses. And so the first person that we hired onto our team was actually a very skilled mechanical engineer. I think Areeb definitely has a lot of kind of incredibly full stack engineering experience. So as context, the first ever robot that we installed in a recycling facility was 100% just Areeb. Like he sourced all the parts, he integrated it, he programmed it, he tested it in the lab. Okay, I will volunteer that I helped him actually physically install the thing, but it was all him, right? But at the core of it, we knew that his background was more on the software and the AI development side of things. And so we said, okay, if we really want to take this incredibly multifaceted and very difficult to build robot to the next level, we probably should hire someone who has that actual industrial engineering experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask, who's building the robots? Wait, are the robots made from sustainable material?
It's a great question. So we have definitely done kind of our own end-of-life analyses on our systems, and it's sort of a meta question of, are these waste-ending robots themselves helping to end waste when they're out of commission? We currently source a number of our parts from these very reliable OEMs, and so we do a certain analysis to understand, like, what is the material that's being put into each of these parts. And then we also work with a lot of local vendors as well for some of the parts on our robot. So it is definitely a mission of ours, once we've figured out like what this overall system looks like, to start thinking about how do we reduce our own environmental footprint. But there are many ways that we as a company have already tried to start doing that in any way possible.
No, that's so interesting. Because I'll never forget, I was walking by a bar in my neighborhood. This was a couple of months ago. And there are two guys outside chatting about how they don't understand why the country is spending money on wind turbines, because they're like, don't wind turbines just become trash? And I was just like, you know, that's not the way to look at it. And I was like, but that's a point being made. Like, I get why you think that a little bit. It's not right, but I get it.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, you know, one perhaps simplistic way to look at it is just over the lifespan of the robot, how much waste is it actually helping to end? And what's the climate impact of that? And then compare that with the similar or analogous waste or climate impact produced by disposing of the robot itself, right? So you certainly want that equation to net out in favor of the robot's impact versus the cost of the robot to the environment. But anything we can do to sort of stack it even more in favor of impact over the robot's own footprint is definitely trending in the direction of where we want to be as a company.
And how are you hoping to expand this? Because there's so many things. I'm thinking of like batteries and metals and stuff. Like, do the robots already deal with recycling that? Or is that like a more focused area you would have to expand into?
Sure. It is definitely a focused area. And so, you know, you can break it down in a couple of different ways. One is purely just like the raw identification and sortation task. So if you're talking about going from sorting discrete items like aluminum cans and water bottles down to trying to sort out little pieces of scrap copper out of a giant pile, like, you definitely can imagine you need a slightly different mechanism for actually grabbing or picking or otherwise sorting those things. And then there's also the question from the business side of how do you best insert yourself into the value chain, right? Depending on what types of recycling stream you're talking about, or even what region you're operating in, the players that are involved are a little bit different. And so the question is, for example, do you go and sell your equipment directly to the recycling facilities, or do you end up partnering a little bit more with the upstream players who have a vested interest in recovering more material and then have them introduce you in through that ecosystem? What's been really fun for me and for Areeb is that we focus a lot on the technology, but the actual business model and just thinking from a systems level about how to create the most change, given all of the variables at our disposal, has also been really, really fun and intellectually rewarding.
And I think we only have time for one last question, but thinking about all the progress you guys have made thus far and where you guys are headed on the roadmap, how do you look at what's next and what's coming up for Glacier?
So in the near term, you know, I think a lot of this recent funding enables us to just take this incredible purpose-built recycling robot that we've spent the past 4 years building and actually just scale it, right? Get a growing fleet across more regions, more recycling facilities, getting it into the hands of operators so that we can really start to make that impact. Further on, there are, I think, so many different ways that we could take this core technology we've built. Certainly on the software side of things, particularly with our AI and these data capabilities, we're seeing that there are so many emerging markets as people start to understand what decisions could even be made with this data. So you can imagine, if you gave me 6 months of engineering time, one key decision is, do I get our AI model to identify more different types of categories, like, you know, polypropylene plastic or something more niche? Or do I get it to start doing something like identifying the brand on different bottles that are coming through the system? So there's that type of bifurcation in the roadmap that we need to decide on. And then longer term, you know, I think there are so many ways that we can use this sortation across different waste streams or recycling streams. I think in addition to residential recycling, there are opportunities like, certainly e-waste recycling is a very hot topic and only going to become even more so. Organics is also becoming very important in a number of states. So what are we doing with our composting? You know, like, are we creating actual value out of that? Construction and demolition. I could list many other waste streams there. And then the last thing that we think about often is, if you're given a hugely heterogeneous amount of stuff and your job is just to design a system that can sort it well, you know, in some respects, if you were to design from scratch, you wouldn't necessarily want a mechanism, whether it's a robot or a person, to literally just pick things item by item when you're dealing with like millions and millions of items. So then the question becomes, are there other ways to design technology to actually achieve better sortation at scale? So it's just a flavor of all of these different avenues of our roadmap that we're constantly thinking about.
I do have one final question. Mm-hmm. Do you name the robots after you build them? It's been killing me the entire time. I just need to know, do they have names?
Many of them do, yes. So we don't have a formal naming process, but early days, there was actually this kind of strange phenomenon where our first couple of robots were coming online timed weirdly aptly to when people on the team were getting nieces and nephews. And so there was just this weird cultural norm of naming the robot after whoever had just recently, you know, had a new niece.
Wait, I love that.
It worked out pretty well. And then more recently, you know, we have our internal naming system, but calling something a number obviously gets really confusing real fast. And so one of our engineers has actually taken to naming some of our most recent equipment after different Taylor Swift songs to really capitalize on that zeitgeist. And, you know, it's pretty funny because sometimes you think about our customers typically being older, male, et cetera. And we were kind of like, how are they going to react to having, you know, a vision system that's named after a Taylor Swift song? They absolutely love it. Like, they think it's hilarious. They're all in. It's great.
Robot blank space. Oh my gosh, we're never getting back together. Oh my gosh, I love it. I love it. Not the Midnight's era. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Absolutely.
No, that's perfect. I always say when I fly JetBlue, I love that they like name the planes and I'm like, oh, I'm flying blue suede shoes. Like, sure. Okay. But I think that's all we have time for. So thank you so much for coming on, Rebecca. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, both of you. I really appreciate it.
And that was our conversation with Rebecca. Dom, what was the lie?
The lie was that if you think something should be recycled and you're not sure you should toss it in the recycling, it turns out that is not true. Alert, alert. You know, if you're not sure where it goes, you should probably throw it in the trash because it turns out that's called wish cycling and you shouldn't do it. And it makes people and the robots' jobs a lot harder.
This conversation reminded me of it. And it's something that I've known and people have been talking about for years, but people want to recycle. And yet it's so hard.
I know.
Like, it's so hard to like be a consumer and actually like make those choices. And like wish cycling is a very cute term, in my opinion, for it. But that's definitely something that I've always been like, it's a frustrating dynamic where it's like people seem legitimately that they want to do this. Even people who are like a little bit weird about some of the other like climate focused initiatives. It seems like everyone's kind of on the same page about recycling. And yet it's like, we like can't get it right.
Yeah, I'm definitely a wish cycler. Like the most obvious thing that I think of like is when I'm drinking coffee in the streets and then I want to throw it out and it's like in a paper cup. I recycle that, right? But then they also have like compost. But then I also see people throw it in the trash because it's like used. But then I don't know, like, what do I do with this? I recycle everything and then I hope that it goes to a better life. But also when I accidentally throw away recycling, I'm like, I hope the trash person helps take that can out and bring it home. You know, like, I guess that's the point of the company is like, people don't know what happens to their stuff after they get rid of it. And it turns out that it's a mess behind the scenes. And there's a lot more technological innovation needed to clean everything up, which is going to help make a more sustainable planet.
Yeah. And this is something I really liked about this company. And well, I don't think consumers should have like no role in helping with the climate crisis by any means. Of course, we should like do what we can. This in particular, because so many people were recycling and are recycling and aren't doing it right and don't even know it, that it's like, I like this approach of being like, these are people who are trying to do the right thing. We'll put in this layer that essentially allows them to do the right thing, even if they didn't actually do it correctly to begin with. Because I feel like that's such a great way to ensure that you get the same goal, even if the parties involved maybe aren't always necessarily sure of what exactly to do.
I'm actually kind of glad the robots are involved because I could not imagine this as a manual job.
Oh, I know.
Just going through, like, do you know how tedious that would be? Like, that's a lot.
As listeners know, I have super fun and exciting hobbies outside of work. So I've actually watched a couple documentaries about these like recycling processing plants overseas. And like, it's really crazy. Like watching them, you'd be And then you're like, oh, this is so far away. Like, this isn't what we do here. And then you're like, oh, no, this is all trash shipped over from the U.S. And you're like, oh, my God.
That's crazy.
It's really crazy.
I cannot believe.
Would recommend looking them up if you want to get sad real fast.
I can't believe we were doing that to other countries. That's crazy. You get to ship your trash to other places. And then because I learned something important last year, and that was, I guess I didn't realize that trash catches on fire. And
oh, my God.
I was talking to someone from India because he had like a company that was trying to address this issue. And he was telling me how, yeah, when you just have a bunch of trash together and like in the landfills, eventually it just catches on fire and it burns endlessly. So he was talking about where he was from in India, how you could just see and smell burning trash all the time.
Yeah.
Because it was just there in the landfill. And I was like, that's crazy. I had no idea that trash just catches on fire because I guess it releases methane or something like that.
Oh, yeah. No, it makes sense. Yeah. And some places even like just burning it is the strategy.
Yeah.
Like that is the plan to burn it. And that's just like, that's so crazy.
Yeah.
To me.
What are we doing, guys?
It is so funny. Like we talked about on the call a bit, just thinking about how like we viewed recycling as kids or like how they taught it to us then. Or I even think about it now, like, as someone who watches the Denver Nuggets, they play at Ball Arena, ball being ball cans. And all of the stuff they do on the court is recycling related for the fans. Like, here's a highlight recycle reel, or like people go out on the court. Their literal tasks is like run this obstacle course that involves you throwing aluminum cans into a recycling bin. Like, it's all recycling focus, which I've always thought is kind of funny. But that doesn't actually matter unless you have stuff like Glaciers tech in there as kind of like that backstop.
Yeah. 8-year-old me thought I was saving the planet, throwing a little bottle away. But you know, it's interesting. And I liked hearing that a company as big as Amazon is interested in this, because a lot of the times, like even when we're talking about recycling, how they told us like, yeah, you know, recycle, it really echoes the whole use a plastic straw and save a turtle thing. And it's like, I can totally do that. But we need really, really big entities like Amazon and these big companies that give us all these packages to really step up also and use technology like this. So I'm glad to see that the onus is being put on what big industry is this big packaging industry.
Big packaging. No, I agree, because that is what's always interesting about climate change initiatives. That's why at the beginning I was like, I like that this is not a consumer focused thing, because even if all of us became perfect climate conscious citizens tomorrow, if the corporations don't, it really does not make as much of a difference as we want it
literally
to. I love to hear that.
Yeah, because I love Taylor Swift, but I'm using a paper straw out here and those things suck. Okay. And you're on a private plane. I'm like, come on, we got to balance this out because I'm suffering with these paper straws to save a turtle. You know, what about me? Sorry. I'm just like, a little, no. Let the record show.
Big
we
pollution.
All hate these things. Yes, we hate these paper straws. And so it's good that this is kind of talking to the people with the power to do change. Because what am I supposed to do with this package after it's gone in the recycle? I have no idea what I'm supposed to do about that.
And it is nice, too, because I know like companies like Amazon, like you see their new futuristic like electric delivery vans. I think those things look crazy with their like Rivian headlights. And I just every time I see one, I'm like, what is that? But it's like you don't think so much of fixing deliveries and stuff like that is the vehicle. And you hear so much less about the actual packaging. And it's like, well, if you get an electric vehicle to deliver packaging that's just as unsustainable, it's like, again, it's like, yeah, you're solving some of the issue, but like not really as much. But I was heartened to hear that brands care about this. I'm sure they'll be forced to care more than they do now at some point. But it's nice that there's so many companies who seem like they kind of want to get ahead of that and fix it and have the data so they can like make it better on their own.
And you know, just this was like a little something, but I thought it was really interesting to note that I guess we're talking about small plastic bags, but just knowing that you can't recycle those in all areas, it reminded me because recently I got new furniture, so I had to get rid of my old furniture. And for the first time, I was like, I tried to get rid of like a mirror and a TV stand, and people were like, you can't just throw that away. And I was like, well, I don't know how to get rid of this stuff. Like, what do I do?
Right.
And then that's when I started looking up and I was like, wait a minute, there are laws around when I can dispose of this and how to do it and how to break it up. And I was like, that's crazy. I didn't know.
Right.
And so it was really interesting to see that there are some things or some materials that you can't recycle in some places.
Yeah, I had no idea that it was a difference, even like across the U.S., like some states allow you to recycle some stuff and some don't. That very much is going to make anyone who's skeptical be like, so what is this all about anyway? Because it's like, you can't blame them for that. I mean, mixed messaging You don't expect that in recycling.
Mixed signals. What are we?
Mixed signals.
Yeah, but you know what? We spoke a little bit about fundraising with her. And the company just got about $7.7 million, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they deserve more for this. They definitely need more. And I don't like how investors were skeptical about how much AI they were using. I feel like that's not something they ask other companies. Why do they care? They just throw money at AI companies. I don't like that at all. I don't like it. This company deserved more.
No, you're so right, because there have been so many pitches that I've gotten for funding rounds where it's like, oh, this is an AI company, or like it's working toward that, or like it's working on training it, or like it's X, Y, and Z. And then you find out they have some like huge staff and you're just like, all right, how much of this is actually AI? But like this company having like real robots being built and being used and only having about 20 people is like, okay, how are they even asking you that? The signs are there. Like, obviously this is AI. I mean, I guess it just speaks to the moment we're in now where it's like VCs want it so bad, but even in the years in half since it became super big, investing in AI, some of them have realized they probably like already got burned.
Yeah, I'm like, there's clearly robots behind the scenes working here. Right. Like, what? And they have names too. Like, respect them, you know? And so it seems like everything about this would be an investor's dream. They deserve more money. Mic drop. That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Found is hosted by myself, TechCrunch senior reporter Becca Skutak, alongside senior reporter Dominic Midori-Davis. Found is produced by Maggie Stamets with editing by Kel. Our illustrator is Bryce Durbin. Found's audience development and social media is managed by Morgan Little, Alyssa Stringer, and Natalie Kreisman. TechCrunch's audio products are managed by Henry Pickovit. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.